From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Trump Towers, Trump Plaza, Trump ties and steaks and golf clubs and casinos. Donald Trump's name is or has been all over. He claims regularly on the campaign trail that his business record, his art of the deal, will make him successful as president. But what about those four bankruptcies, the safety net from his wealthy father, the way Donald Trump does business? This hour on Point, we're looking squarely at Donald Trump's business record. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. How good does the Trump business record look to you? Good enough to qualify him to be president of the United States? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Donald Trump talks about his business record a lot. Here he was in September talking about, well, criticizing President Obama's Iran deal based on what he described as his own great record on deals.
I've been doing deals for a long time. I've been making lots of wonderful deals, great deals. That's what I do. Never, ever, ever in my life have I seen any transaction so incompetently negotiated as our deal with Iran.
Wonderful deals, great deals. What about the bankruptcies? Moderator Chris Wallace asked him about that at the first GOP debate in Cleveland all the way back in August. Here was Trump responding.
On four occasions, I've taken advantage of the laws of this country, like other people. I'm not going to name their names because I'm not going to embarrass, but virtually every person that you read about on the front page of the business sections, they've used the law. The difference is when somebody else uses those laws, nobody writes about it. When I use it, they say, oh, Trump, Trump, Trump. The fact is, I built a net worth of more than $10 billion. I have a great, great company. I employ thousands of people, and I'm very proud of the job I did.
It's great. It's great. It's great. Let's look at that business record. Joining us now from New York is Timothy O'Brien, executive editor of Bloomberg View and Bloomberg Gadfly, author of Trump Nation, The Art of Being the Donald, former editor and business reporter at the New York Times, once sued by Trump, who claimed he misrepresented his net worth. That suit was thrown out in 2011. Timothy O'Brien, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom. It's good to be here.
It's great to have you. And with us from Washington, Michael Cruz, senior staff writer for Politico. His latest story on this says Trump has won a lot, but he has lost a lot, too. Michael Cruz, welcome to On Point. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on, Tom.
So, Tim, first of all, just to be clear, are you all out of the woods on being sued by Donald Trump? Is that over behind you?
That's all behind us. He lost that one and we moved on.
Okay. A couple of years ago, Time Magazine looked at his business record. And in the success category, they put the Grand Hyatt Hotel right in the middle of New York there, Trump Tower, Woolman Rink in Central Park, 40 Wall Street, Trump Place, The Apprentice. Everybody's seen that on TV. In the not-so-successful, they put the things where he's filled, Trump Airlines, Trump Vodka, Trump Casinos. That's a big one. Trump the Game, Trump Magazine, Trump Steaks, GoTrump.com, Trump University all got a thumbs down from Time. When you look at those two lists side by side, does that tell the story, Tim O'Brien, of Donald Trump's business record?
Well, I think the first thing to recognize is that everything that's in the win category in there was largely done in the 1980s. And there's no question but that during the 1980s, he made quite a splash, largely around showy real estate projects in Manhattan. And he fixed a skating rink. Since the late 1980s, he hasn't done completed a large real estate project that he's owned in New York. Since that time, he's also put a publicly controlled casino company, a publicly traded casino company that he ran for about a decade, and it was never profitable during his entire run, and he put it through four corporate bankruptcies. So, you know, the reality of his career is that he was, I think, to his credit, a poster child, poster boy for the resurgence of the New York real estate market in the 1980s. And then got into the casino business. Shortly after that, he went on this massive debt binge. He was financially undisciplined. He was a poor manager. And all of that sort of blew up in his face. And the person who emerged in the 90s before he had a second act with The Apprentice was essentially somebody who licensed his name like a human shingle onto products ranging from mattresses and vodka to underwear and real estate. Eventually developed some golf courses and then became the star of The Apprentice. And that's essentially who he is now. That hasn't changed very much over the last decade. So the notion that he's a great deal maker or that he's a great business person around any of the kind of standard definitions of either of those terms is just a fluke. You know, he's not a disciplined businessman. He's not demonstrated financial discipline during a core part of his career. But he is a wonderful self-promoter. But there's a difference between being a great self-promoter and being a great businessman.
Michael Cruz, remind us of where Donald Trump came from. His father laid the foundation for the family fortune. Remind us of that foundation, Fred Trump, and the handoff to Donald.
Where Donald Trump came from is money. He grew up rich, quite rich, in the boroughs of New York and always wanted to go into Manhattan to sort of best his father. But his father was a millionaire many times over, hundreds of millions of dollars, built middle-class homes and apartments in Brooklyn and Queens. So one of the things that Trump had as an advantage in the 80s when he was, as Tim says, much more legitimate as a business success in his own right, one of the things he had was a safety net. He never really had to worry about risk because his father, his family would always save him and did ultimately in the 90s when he needed to be saved.
You've written that in the 80s, he went on this shopping jag, quoting you here, overpaying for properties with hundreds of millions of dollars borrowed from banks. Give us a sense of when he sort of went for it. What was he picking up with? What kind of borrowed money? How much of his own? How did that turn out?
Well, my favorite example of this is probably Trump's shuttle. He took out a $400 million loan to pay $365 million to Eastern Air Shuttle for a fleet of planes that was valued by the company, that had just been valued by the company at $300 million, and then proceeded to basically run the airline into the ground. He wanted to put marble fixtures into the planes and couldn't do that, obviously, because the planes wouldn't be able to fly and stay in the air.
A little heavy. He bought a $29 million 280-foot yacht. Was that a business decision, or was that part of making the reputation of Big Trump?
It was a prop. It was a vanity play. He bought it so that essentially he could park it next to the casino. He spent a bunch of money to dredge the channel there in Atlantic City to park his yacht, which he purchased from Sultan of Brunei, so that people would look at him in a certain way. This has been the playbook from the get-go, but in particular, as Tim pointed out, post-1980s.
And, of course, he went into the casinos in a big way. And how did that turn out, Tim? How much money in? What kind of result out?
Well, yeah, as we mentioned earlier, you know, the result out were four corporate bankruptcies and he lost control of the casinos. I think in his early days in Atlantic City, he was in there early enough where he was printing money out of the first casinos that he ran there. But like many things that he's touched that are already in well-positioned, he had grander designs on them that weren't tied to any kind of financial discipline or any kind of strategic discipline. As he did in other parts of his business, he larded the casinos with debt. He maneuvered around various partners, including Hilton and Holiday Inns, to get control of properties that he then ultimately didn't manage effectively and blew up, by piling too much debt on them. And it's interesting when he speaks publicly in the debates now about those four corporate bankruptcies. He rightly distinguishes that he hasn't been through a personal bankruptcy, although and as Michael has pointed out, Donald owes quite a bit to the largesse of his father's fortune and his siblings' financial support. He came very close in the early 90s to personal bankruptcy. He had personally guaranteed about $900 million in debt that he barely managed to pay off, but he did, to his credit. But on the corporate side, as we mentioned earlier, he engineered four corporate bankruptcies, And he routinely says in the debates, well, I use the laws to my advantage, as do many other people, business people in the United States. Well, the reality is that not a lot of other marquee business people in the United States are serial bankruptcy artists. And while those bankruptcies might have gotten him out of some of the messes that he created in the casino business, the downside of that was investors who invested in those properties got nuked. Employees, working class people who worked at those casinos lost jobs. The city of Atlantic City obviously has suffered from the casino downturn. Some of that is due to larger changes in the gambling industry, but it's also due to the mismanagement of casino owners like Donald Trump.
You know, Michael Cruz, many people look at Donald Trump and they hear some of these criticisms. The bankruptcies sit out there, but then they say, hey, the guy's worth $10 billion, he says. How bad a businessman can he be?
So here's the thing. I mean, he is absolutely a success of a certain kind. I mean, I would go so far as to say he's a genius of a certain sort. He's been very, very, very successful at what is really his core business, which is not and hasn't been for a while the building of actual tangible things, the building of buildings. It's been the building of his brand, the building of the value or the perceived value, which is value of its own kind, of those five letters of T-R-U-M-P. I mean, he has turned those five letters into an ATM for most of his adult life.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about Donald Trump's business record. It's what he puts up front as his qualification for the presidency. Builder, dealmaker. So what's the actual record? We're diving in today with Timothy O'Brien, author of Trump Nation, Michael Cruz, former reporter for The New York Times, once sued by Donald Trump over how he estimated the size of Trump's net worth. Michael Cruz is with us as well. He is senior staff writer for Politico, has written a lot about this. You can join us. What do you want to know about Donald Trump's business career? What does his record say about his deal-making skill, his acuity, his steady hand? Is Donald Trump the business leader he suggests? Is he a great marketer? Of course, running lately, he's been talking about being that builder. Here he was yesterday at an event in Bluffton, South Carolina, saying he'd fix America's infrastructure. Just look at his record as a builder.
First of all, I know how to build. What I know how to do best is to build. Wouldn't it be nice to have a president that knew how to build, because we have to rebuild our country? And knew how to negotiate. You know, I'm building a hotel that actually I got from the government. It's under budget, ahead of schedule. It's 2 years ahead of schedule. Having somebody that has that ability. I've always had the ability, under budget, ahead of schedule.
Under budget, ahead of schedule. Of course, if you look around, not everybody is so happy. Just this week on Morning Edition on NPR, they were talking with some folks in Scotland where Donald Trump put up a golf course, promised a lot of stuff. Here was Scottish National Party leader Alex Salmond saying, telling NPR's Lila Faudel he used to be one of Donald Trump's biggest fans.
Donald said wonderful things about the billions of dollars he was going to invest, the thousands of jobs that were going to be created. Now, 8 years later, I reckon the investment has amounted to perhaps a tenth of that.
And here's David Milne talking with NPR's Lila Faudel. He lives next to Donald Trump's golf course near Aberdeen.
He promises the earth, delivers nothing. As far as that goes, he's in a good position to be a politician. But as far as the real world goes, no. Do not trust this man with anything.
No, thank you, says that one man in Scotland. Of course, there are many stories here. It's a long career now, 40 years. How do you begin to draw a kind of summary under a big career like that, Tim O'Brien? I mean, how do you size up when Donald Trump puts himself forward as a major builder, can rebuild the country, a major business leader? How do you take the measure of that?
Well, you know, Tom, I think he's a well-known builder. There's no disputing that. He's got a long track record of projects that bear his name. But as always is the case with Donald, you have to scratch beneath the surface a little bit. As Michael has pointed out, and I think accurately, he is a success of a certain sort. You know, he's a deft and wily self-promoter. He's got strong instincts for people, a certain kind of passion among the electorate and among the fans of The Apprentice. And he knows how to speak to a certain sense of glitz and success. But that ability to self-promote is really, I think, distinct from his ability to manage and operate. And, you know, he hasn't had a large ownership stake in most of the projects that he's been involved with since the mid-1990s. He licenses his name to partners who generally finance the projects and bring him on as a contractor and a manager. And in exchange, he gets a fee for those duties, and he gets to put his name on the building, and he gets a licensing fee for that.
But they bring him on as a manager. That sounds like a vote of confidence.
Well, I think he's got a track record of getting buildings put together and getting them built. There's no question about that. But by standard measures of the value of the real estate he owns, or the square footage of the real estate that he owns, he's simply not the largest real estate developer in Manhattan, which is a line he's used repeatedly in the opening of The Apprentice when the show begins. He's not someone on the order of a Durst or a Spire or a Tishman or Brookfield Properties or Steve Ross's company. He's just not in that league and never really has been.
Michael, you quote Harry Hurt, who wrote a book called Lost Tycoon, saying about Donald Trump, he's probably the greatest self-promoter and self-spinmeister that's ever lived. You quote Wayne Barrett saying he's been able to create his own reality. You know, there are a lot of Republicans who are freaked out about Donald Trump sort of taking over. This is not a real conservative. Ross Douthat, writing the New York Times not long ago, you know, says, hey, people, go after his business record. He said, quoting him here, said, tell people that he isn't the incredible self-made genius he plays on TV. Tell them about all the money he inherited from his daddy. Tell them about the bailouts that saved him from ruin. Tell them about all his cratered companies. Find people who suffered from those fiascos, workers laid off after bankruptcies, homeowners who bought through Trump University, people who ponied up for sham degrees from Trump University, or just take a camera crew around Atlantic City and slap Trump's name on what you find. Is that fair, Michael? Or is that what you do when you're going – I mean, everybody's got their successes and failures. Is that just going after the downside?
No, I think it's absolutely fair. And by the way, it's something that has been done. And of course, it can continue to be done. It can be done more. But none of this stuff isn't known or isn't, I should say, available mm-hmm. to be known. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't seem to stick. And we're in February and getting deeper and deeper into the primary season.
Yes.
And he is not – getting hurt by this reality, by these realities. Has he had some successes? Yes. Has he had many abject failures? Yes. Should those be a part of the equation? Yes. Are they being considered by voters? Not really. They don't seem to be sticking to him. And I think it goes to what has been always a central tenet of how he operates, which is say something, say what you want to be true, even if it's not, over and over and over. And then in some sense, that will be true, or that will be true for enough people. Now, whether it's true for enough voters ultimately to put Donald J. Trump into the Oval Office, I suppose we'll see.
I guess what really matters is how the patterns and habits and skills he's developed as a businessman might play out hypothetically in the White House. I mean, Tim O'Brien, you look in some depth at the story of Donald Trump and Manhattan's what's called the West Side Yards. This is a former Penn Central, big piece of real estate on the west side of New York that Donald Trump made a major play around years ago now. What did you learn from looking at that? It was maybe the biggest play of his life.
Oh, it certainly was the biggest and would have been the biggest real estate play of his life, Tom. He came into the West Side Yards, which was a huge stretch of property on the west side of Manhattan between the 50s and the 70s, abutting the Hudson River. And he had acquired it initially. He got an option during the bankruptcy of the Penn Central Railroad. It was a great example of all the early advantages he enjoyed.
He was pretty young still. This is all the way back in the, 70s?
1974 or so. And
he could go in and buy it for $100 plus million.
Well, he actually got an option on the property with no money down. And that was largely engineered with the help of his father and political connections with the Democratic machine in New York. And he positioned himself to get an option on the property. The option lapsed. He reacquired the option a little bit later in the late 70s. And then an Argentine businessman took control of the property. He ran into trouble, and Trump got control of it in the mid 1980s. And had he been able to develop that property, it would have easily been one of the biggest projects ever built in Manhattan. It would have rivaled Rockefeller Center. It would have been on the scale of Canary Wharf in London.
Which is huge. So this goes to the issue of when you get in the middle of a great big deal, like presidents are in the middle of all the time, how do you work with the parties? How does it work out?
Correct. And he needed to work with City Hall at the time to get the property zoned. He wanted to put a gigantic spaceship-shaped high rise on the property that would have cast shadows all the way into New Jersey and up the West Side. He wanted to move NBC's television headquarters into the parcel and then build a lot of residences and other commercial property. And he needed City Hall's help to get that done. And instead, he ended up in this sort of epic, only in New York, verbal battle with Ed Koch. You know, he called for Koch's resignation. Koch famously called Donald piggy, piggy, piggy. And then at the end of the day, he didn't get the project done because he couldn't play well with the other children. And what ended up happening out of that was he again had larded that project with debt, more debt than he could handle. His bankers took it away from him ultimately, and it was sold to a group of Chinese investors in the early noughts, I think around 2004. Mm-hmm. And they effectively got it built. And they hired him to manage the site. He got to put his name on a few of the buildings, but he lost control of it. And when they sold it a few years later, it was the largest real estate transaction at the time in New York City history. I think it was around $1.8 billion in 2008. And he got a portion of the proceeds from that sale. But it was really this incredible missed opportunity. And I think it goes to the core of why voters should be wary of what a Trump White House might look like, because it revealed all of his strengths that were more than offset by his myriad weaknesses. He was a visionary. He thought large. He wanted to do something that was historic, and that's always been part of his own sense of himself. But to get it done, he needed to do everything that one would associate with being a good manager and deal maker, being able to negotiate deftly, to compromise, to demonstrate financial discipline, to work with people with different points of view, et cetera, none of which he couldn't do, and he couldn't do it in spades.
And there was a bunch of the back and forth with Mayor at that time, Ed Koch, that seems familiar from what we see on the campaign trail. I mean, he ended up dashing off this letter to Koch saying that the behavior of Koch and his staff were ludicrous and disgraceful. He said back then the Koch's New York had become a cesspool of corruption, incompetence.
It was bedlam, he said.
Bedlam
in New York.
Koch said, yeah. Trump was squealing like a stuck pig. I mean, is that a pattern that it comes down to that kind of a shouting match of insults?
Look at him with Jeb Bush. I mean, it's been replicated there in every debate platform he's been on with Jeb Bush. And this past week with Ted Cruz, you know, he said.
But they're fighting in politics. Politics is rough. Of course, Trump goes fast to the tough language. That's true.
Well, I think, you know, public forums can be tough. And the thing that people have to understand about Donald Trump is that he thinks about himself cinematically. When I was working on the book, he told me that before he joined his father's real estate business, he had thought about going out to Hollywood and being a movie producer. And I think his favorite movie is High Plains Drifter. And he thinks of himself, I think, in almost Clint Eastwood-esque tones, and someone who is the center of attention will settle scores, will duel it out. And I think it's why he makes those hilarious sort of grimaces in public photos. I think he thinks of himself as this sort of epic gunslinger. And it's really that sort of sense of himself that carries him through a series of debates during or debates and moments in this election season that would have derailed anyone else, from questioning John McCain's record as a war veteran to saying that Fox's Megyn Kelly must have been menstruating when she asked him tough questions as a debate at a debate. And the thing that pulls him through that, I think, is this cinematic sense of himself.
Of course, Americans may want that visionary, that epic gunslinger. There may be, in the polls, he's doing pretty darn well. Maybe that's what people want. Tim O'Brien, Michael Cruz, please stand by. Callers for the two of you. Adam in Council Bluffs, Iowa. Adam, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I just want to make a comment. I just read a Washington Post article a while back, and they had a pretty interesting thing from 1988 that said Donald Trump is worth quadrupled from $1 billion to $4 billion. Warren Buffett and Bill Gates' wealth increased from $1 billion to $80 billion over the same period. And Buffett had about $2.5 billion in 88 and went to $68 billion today. So those two, to me, are successful. Donald Trump is not successful to me, because it goes on to say that he would just would have invested his money in 1978 in the S&P 500 and reinvested in the dividends, he'd be worth twice as much today.
Adam, we've got it. Just the math of it right there, plus the scale of some other business folks' accomplishment, I guess. I mean, Michael Cruz, can you put him in the camp of Gates and Buffett and right on down?
No, but if he had invested the money he had, his father's money, in 1978 in the S&P 500, nobody would know his name if that's all he did, and so he couldn't be running for president. You know, sometimes I think the Donald Trump who's running for president is not actually Donald Trump. It's Donald Trump from The Apprentice. And Donald Trump would not be running nearly so successfully. Donald Trump from The Apprentice is. He is running that successfully.
Meaning the character that he presented there.
The less complicated version of Donald Trump. The Donald Trump has always sort of wanted himself to be. He's always envisioned himself as essentially the character he was allowed to play on his reality TV show, which saved him. I mean, it didn't save him. He was still doing okay post-90s financial trough. But that is really what put him in position to challenge for this. He has often from 2000 on, even as far back as the 1980s, another story I wrote, he's talked about the potential of running for president. I suspect he never really thought he could do that successfully.
But here he is.
Now he could. Now he can.
Center stage. Corey in Buffalo. Corey, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
So, I mean, granted, Trump has a checkered business past, but how many large businesses out there have not had failures? I mean, how can you judge his ability to be president by, you know, in the fact that he's came back? It's not like he's right now, you know, $40 million in debt trying to get out of a hole. He's on top of it.
And you welcome that, Corey. Do you welcome, even with a checkered record, and as you say, many business people have such a thing, do you welcome him in the race?
I welcome the fact that he's not a career politician. I welcome the fact that he's not taking money from special interest groups to run his campaign, so he's not in anybody's back pocket.
Corey, I think you speak for a lot of people when you say that, and I appreciate your call. Tim O'Brien, Michael Cruz, we'll come right back and look at that and a lot more. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
This On Point podcast is supported by Squarespace, the simplest way to create a beautiful website. Whether your passion is bold, unconventional, or just plain crazy, you should share it with the world in an unforgettable way. Start your free trial today at squarespace.com/onpoint. That's squarespace.com/onpoint.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Donald Trump's business record. It's what he puts up front as his qualification for the presidency, builder, dealmaker. So what is the actual record? It is a long record at this point, and there are successes and there are failures. In some sense, you have to look into that, through that, and see, well, what kind of operator has he been within all that? Never, ever shy about bragging on that record. Here he was in Mobile, Alabama, campaigning, promoted his book, The Art of the Deal, brought a woman up on stage who had brought her own copy to the Trump rally.
Whether it's Trump, The Art of the Deal, which Obama and Kerry obviously did not read when they did this crazy deal with a... Oh, look! The Art of the Deal. Come here, give me that book. I love that book. You know, I said the other day, because so many people, they carry around The Art of the Deal because they're begging their politicians, please, please, read The Art of the Deal when you negotiate with China and with Japan and with Mexico and with Vietnam and with Saudi Arabia.
Read my book, The Art of the Deal. You know how to get things done. Michael Cruz is with us from Politico. Tim O'Brien was with the New York Times, now at Bloomberg View and Bloomberg Gadfly, author of Trump Nation. Tim, Michael, here's one listener. Wes says, come on, you guys are slicing and dicing. I mean, look at his post-80s successes. The Trump Tower in Chicago, the Doral Resort in Miami, Liberty National Golf, City Island Golf in New York, the Golf Resort in Scotland, Union Station in Washington, D.C., on and on. You're underselling his successes. What do you say, Tim?
I don't think his successes are undersold. I think he's had a series of one-off projects that have been modestly successful, but they don't put him into the ranks of America's leading business people. They simply don't. He's a self-promoter. And I don't think that's a matter of opinion. You can look at his track record, size up what he's done, compare the value of what he's built against other people who have been truly successful as business people, and he doesn't match up. As Michael, I think, said so wonderfully a little while ago, the person who was a reality TV star has morphed into a reality political candidate. And I think people are latching on to him because he embodies their anger. We're in the middle of a difficult economy. And he speaks, I think, often to people's most sort of sensationalist fears. And I think even if the tally of his track record as a businessman includes more failures than successes, and there's a debate about pairing those things against one another, I think it's inescapable that you can deny that he's been a poor manager. And I think that, again, goes to what a Trump White House might look like. Is he a person voters are going to be comfortable with having his finger on the nuclear button? You know, he's introduced immigration, trade, and tax policies that are all profoundly harebrained. I mean, they're not viable. And he doesn't really have a political platform. He has a pogo stick, and he just keeps bouncing around from issue to issue. And I frankly think that if he could get voter attention by pulling his pants down in Times Square, he would go ahead and do that. And I think voters have to kind of get their arms around that.
We'll put you in the category, I guess, of not a fan. Gail in Brookline, Massachusetts. Gail, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. My question is about his other businesses besides real estate,
yeah.
Manufacturing. He's always talking about our manufacturing jobs going to China, Vietnam, Mexico. Where were or are his factories? I know his daughter's business is closing, is made in China. He may have some backing of her business as well. I just wondered about that point, and I'll take my answer off air. Thank you.
Thank you, Gail. I mean, not a lot of manufacturing in this CV, Michael Cruz, but what about it?
He's been talking about this since literally 1987. He took out an ad in three major newspapers saying, essentially, go back and read it. I wrote a story about this not too long ago. He said then, basically, what he's saying now on the stump. Other countries are taking advantage of us. We are being laughed at. I mean, so many things have happened in the last 30 years to show that, you know, we were then and we are now the global superpower, certainly a global superpower. I mean, all of his doom and gloom hasn't exactly played out.
Yeah, but did he manufacture overseas, he and his family, when they were making things, or did they make things?
No,
that's probably something.
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Mike. I'm sorry.
That's probably something better for you to answer.
Tim, how about it?
The shirts that he sold at Macy's under his men's clothing line were all produced in Asia. He's had immigrant workers on his construction sites in New York. He famously had illegal Polish laborers tear down historic friezes on the old Bonwit Teller building in the dead of night. The whole procedure was enabled by illegal immigrant workers. He's had immigrant workers at his casinos in Atlantic City. So this notion that you know, he hasn't personally benefited from immigrant labor or from trade with China is hypocritical. However, I think the thing to remember when he lays out the issue with China and what's happened with jobs is over 3 million manufacturing jobs, you know, have been lost between 2001 and the present, more or less. That can be, I think, directly tied to trade agreements with China. And but that's, I think, one of the downsides of free trade. And new jobs get created in the wake of that. He's now, you know, proposing a 45% tariff on Chinese imports. He later denied that he had proposed that, but in fact he did. It's not a legal tariff under the WTO agreements. But as with many things, he's touched on obviously an issue here that matters to working class voters, particularly white male voters who had manufacturing jobs that aren't coming back. He's identified that as an important issue that the country needs to address. But the way he actually assesses it and thinks about ways to cure it are again, sort of profoundly harebrained.
Cheryl in Milford, Connecticut. Cheryl, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. What do you think?
Well, you know, there's been a lot of talk from Bush and Kasich about how many jobs they created when they were governors, but not much has come out about what Donald Trump has done, how many jobs he employs people in, and how many executive women he employs.
And you're ready to give him credit for both of those, it sounds like, Cheryl.
Yeah, I mean, he's definitely created a lot of jobs, and I know that there's a lot of women that are in executive positions with his company, and you know, I think that's something that needs to be noted.
Let us pick it up. Michael, what about Donald Trump as a job creator and as an employer or colleague of executive women?
He's always had some women working for him, including in higher-up positions. At the same time, the Trump Organization has always been, and Tim will have to speak to the specific numbers here, but has always been, as I understand it, significantly smaller than he wants people to believe it is.
When it comes to the number of women or job creation
or period,
overall?
Period. Job. Number of people working for him.
What about the job? You know, I've created lots of jobs and I've got lots of happy employees. Tim.
Well, you know, I think on a net basis, if you look at the collapse of the casino holdings, that destroyed more jobs than it created. And within real estate, on a lot of those projects, they're simply contractors that he's employed on an episodic basis. The Trump Organization itself is, you know, in Trump Tower, and I would imagine right now it's currently at tops a few dozen people. You know, he had in the past, Cranes used to do an assessment of the largest private employers in New York, and the Trump Organization was routinely at the top of that list, but only because he included all of the casino employees in Atlantic City. And had you stripped those numbers out, he wouldn't have been in the top ranks. So the Trump Organization itself is a very small operation that is populated by former bodyguards and former associates of his that he's collected over the years, but it's certainly not a Fortune 500 company by any stretch.
As you say, his name, his brand, is slapped on a lot of things. Lewis in Atlanta, Georgia. Lewis, you're on.
Hi, Tom. I would say that I would venture to say that look no further than Trump University, esteemed academia, set up to teach you the secrets of Donald Trump's business acumen and set up in 2005. And for $1,500, 3-day seminar, you could get your foot in the door. And it lasted till 2010. 7,600 students paid. Some of them paid for the bigger packages that were offered at that 3-day seminar. The biggest one of all, the elite, $35,000. Out of those 7,600 students, about 99% of them have filed a lawsuit trying to get it all together as a class action suit. And, well, what more can I say?
Let us ask about it. Trump University, he didn't really pretend it was a full-on university. It was a kind of, what, short course, Michael or Tim, in how to do business, the Trump way? How did that turn out?
I feel like I've been going to Trump University, and you can do it for a lot less money. You can buy most of his books, and he's written many for
yeah, but a lot of people charge for coming and hearing lectures, right? I mean, it's not an unknown business. Did he do well at it? Did he do well by the people who signed up for it?
I think he did well. I'm not sure the people did well. I'm not sure the people gained much from that they couldn't have gotten from those books. And I would go back to the Art of the Deal. I mean, Trump wants people to read the Art of the Deal, and I agree with him. I think that book, which was his first, which came out in 1987, is essentially his campaign playbook. I mean, he talks then a lot about his methods, which he is employing still today and with great success on the campaign trail. I mean, he says it outright. It's not just what he's done. It's what he himself has said. I play to people's fantasies. People may not always think big themselves, but they can still get very excited by those who do. That's why a little hyperbole never hurts. People want to believe that something is the biggest and the greatest and the most spectacular. I mean, truthful hyperbole is, I think, a trenchant, an important phrase when it comes to knowing and thinking about Donald Trump.
Make America great again. Trump University, I'm reading here, Tim, that in 2013, New York Attorney General sued Trump and the quote-unquote university for $40 million for allegedly defrauding students. Did that suit stick?
I don't know how that particular suit was resolved, Tom. But it did cut to the core at the time it was filed about, are you getting what is being promoted? And the result there was a fairly resounding no. There were students who paid with the expectation of getting training and getting access to the Trump magic and ended up feeling like their pockets had been picked. The FBI at the time, around the time Trump University had been launched, had done a number of sort of stings on fly-by-night online education companies. In one case, they were able to get a cat to graduate from one of the classes. And I think, you know, there was this
moment. That was not Trump's, or was it?
That was not Trump's.
Okay,
it was another company. Mm-hmm. But there was this moment when online education was the thing in the mid-noughts. And he jumped on that, branded it, but it was never managed properly, and it didn't really deliver what it claimed to.
Steve in Moline, Illinois. Steve, thank you for calling. You're on.
Yes, I was calling, and I wonder if your guest could corroborate this. I lived in South Florida for about 6 years, 2005, 2011, a small town called South Palm Beach, which was 5 or 6 miles, 7 miles down the road from Mar-a-Lago, Trump residence in Palm Beach.
This giant mansion and grounds there on kind of Billionaire's Row.
Correct. And Rod Stewart and a lot of others, you know. And anyhow, he also had real estate holdings across the inland waterway in downtown West Palm Beach. And I worked for a construction equipment supply house and equipment rental house. And so we had dealings with a lot of contractors, some of whom did work for Mr. Trump in one capacity or another on his various real estate holdings. The rumor and the word from the contractors was that Mr. Trump would have a habit of hiring them to do large projects. They would get nearly complete, and then he would sue them and then tie up payment in court and then hire other contractors to come in and finish the job. So I can't corroborate that, but I was wondering if your guests could and or talk about the rather contentious relationship he had with West Palm and Palm Beach and his business practices.
Maybe more than we can get to, Steve, but let me pick up the heart of it there. I mean, he's litigious. Tim O'Brien, he went after you. But beyond the rumor on the street in Florida, anything firm that you can say about Steve's observation?
He historically has had a reputation of using the courts to obviously to settle scores. And he's had attorneys on different occasions, I think, where there's been claims that he didn't pay his attorneys in full or he didn't pay contractors in full. And he is rumored to have said in some of those private transactions that you've gotten a lot of benefit out of simply working with me because working with me gets you better known. But those are all private transactions, and it would be hard for me to, with any specificity to identify any in particular.
Michael, do you think – is this different for other businessmen? I mean, a full career of business, and Trump's had a long one. It's going to have all kinds of things in it. If you open the hood on – you name it, any businessman who might put his hand up to run for the presidency, would you find this kind of gnarly, checkered reality?
Hard to say, but I don't think so. I mean, one of the things that has made Trump Trump is that even when he does fail, clearly he proclaims it a success and proclaims it loudly and repeatedly enough to the point where people think it was.
Well, the whole country can sit, ponder the detail of Trump's business record and decide where to go with that. That visionary sort of depiction of his career and of the world clearly getting him some traction right now. We'll see how it turns out in South Carolina and beyond. Michael Cruz at Politico, senior staff writer there. Thanks for joining us from Washington today, Michael.
Thanks so much.
And Timothy O'Brien, author of Trump Nation, The Art of Being the Donald. Tim, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks, Tom.
Listeners, thank you for all your thoughts and comments online. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.